Hello and welcome to Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters, and today we'll examine a number of stories and issues in the news. We'll begin in a moment and assess whether the war would be better for Libyans than the threat they faced from Gaddafi. An expert in the law of war, Asla Bali, a professor at UCLA School of Law, joins us. Then we'll be joined by Mark Danner, the author of Stripping Bare the Body, Politics, Violence, War. We'll be talking about the Arab Spring and how the Libyan intervention is splitting the left with liberal interventionists on one side and anti-imperialists on the other. And then finally, we'll talk about The End of Wall Street, the title of a book by Roger Lowenstein, a financial journalist formerly with The Wall Street Journal who now writes for The New York Times and Smart Money. And the question is, will we end Wall Street? Or will Wall Street end us? And a last-minute reminder that you still have time to join me at the UCLA Hammer Museum in Westwood at 7 p.m. tonight for a free public forum on Africa's largest country, Sudan, which is just about to split into two. Let's now turn to the situation in Libya. I'm joined by Asla Bali, who is a professor at the UCLA School of Law, where she teaches courses on public international law, international human rights, and the laws of war. At Yale Law School, she was the coordinator of the Middle East Legal Forum. And welcome to Background Briefing, Asla Bali.
Thank you very much.
You wrote a recent article where you were assessing whether the war in Libya will be better for Libyans than the threat they faced from Gaddafi. Where does that argument stand in your mind?
So in the original article, we were writing in response to calls for a no-fly zone, and our assessment was that one took a cost-benefit analysis of the likely consequences of imposing simply a no-fly zone, the likelihood that was that would impose costs on Libyan civilians without concomitant benefits, since a no-fly zone was unlikely to decisively alter the military calculation simply by eliminating the aerial capacities of the Gaddafi regime, since those capacities were not principally used against civilians in Libya. Obviously, the actual authorization in UN Security Council Resolution 1973 has gone much farther than simply a no-fly zone. It also authorizes all necessary measures to protect civilians short of an occupation of Libya through an invading ground force, which incidentally doesn't preclude ground forces from being used. And indeed, I believe that NATO is currently at least contemplating the possibility that ground forces might be required for a stabilization regime should the current Gaddafi regime be ousted as a result of the aerial assault that NATO has undertaken at the moment. And they would, I imagine, simply say that any ground forces that would be used for that purpose would not be there as an invading or occupying force and therefore would remain in compliance with the Security Council resolution. But in any case, the Security Council resolution offers a much, much wider authorization than simply a no-fly zone. We've seen the effect of that in the aerial assault that NATO has undertaken, or I should say that the U.S., France, and the U.K. have undertaken and that is now moving to NATO command, which has entailed attacking the regime's ground forces and, in fact, targeting units particularly that are the most effective and the most loyal of the Gaddafi regime. And there is reason to think that some of the aerial attack has actually exceeded even the quite expansive Security Council authorization insofar as they appear to have been attacking Gaddafi's forces when they were in retreat or when they were not engaged in any kind of combat, and therefore it seems to exceed the parameters of measures strictly to protect civilians, since forces that are in retreat or forces that are not in any kind of engagement are, of course, not actively endangering civilians. So in any case, we see a much, much wider authorization of force and an even more expansive use of force than was authorized. And under these circumstances, the cost-benefit analysis changes. But it remains an open question whether ultimately this is better in the medium and long term for Libyan civilians. The first thing I would note is that there are civilians in Libya throughout the territory and not only in the eastern provinces. So whereas I think it's likely that the initial aerial assault may have prevented a potential slaughter of Libyan civilians in Benghazi. That is a real likelihood. I mean, of course, this is completely now a counterfactual. We can't say with certainty that that would have happened, but there's reason to think it might have happened, and it was potentially averted by the aerial assault. So civilians in Benghazi in that proximate moment certainly might have gained. But there are also civilians in Tripoli, there are civilians in Ras Lanuf, there are civilians throughout the country, obviously, and we have no way of knowing at this point what the consequences of the aerial assault have been for those civilians. For example, there's a report this morning that a hospital was struck in one part of Libya. There's no way that we can confirm or deny whether that's the case, but if it were the case, that a hospital was attacked or was struck in Mizdah outside of Ras Lanuf, well, that would obviously be a cost that's being borne by civilians. So in order to make an assessment now of the relative benefit of this aerial tactic, for civilians, we would need a lot more information about the consequences on the ground. In addition, the aerial assault has not been militarily decisive. The Qaddafi regime's forces are continuing to, at times, gain ground, at times lose ground. But essentially what we're seeing is a protracted conflict on the ground that has not been decisively shifted in favor of those who are resisting the Qaddafi regime. And therefore, that ground conflict is continuing to generate civilian casualties as well. So overall, it's very difficult to say at this point whether or not this operation in the short term has concretely benefited civilians. More importantly, I think, is the medium and long-term potential consequences. So, for example, the idea that NATO is debating a potential stabilization force, and that decision hasn't been taken, but the idea that it's even on the table suggests that Libyans, in a day-after scenario, should the Qaddafi regime fall, may find themselves not in control of choices that are made about subsequent forms of government that they might be subjected to. They may very well find that the decision-making is going to be either shared with international forces that now have a clear stake in outcomes in Libya, or even imposed externally, at least in an initial period. And given how little we know about the forces currently that are in fact in resistance to the Qaddafi regime, what we know about them at this point is that they're united in their opposition to the regime. And so there are a number of different kinds of groups that were centered in Benghazi and the eastern provinces that oppose the Qaddafi regime and are willing to take up arms against it. What we don't know is what unites them beyond that opposition, if anything, and what the composition is, in fact, of the different forces at play. So on the one hand, their international representatives, people like Mahmoud Jibril, are Western-trained academics who speak the language of democracy, civil society, and so forth, and are potentially quite attractive from the perspective of the allied forces that are now seeking to support the armed rebellion. But it's completely unclear the extent of support that somebody like Mahmoud Jibril actually enjoys domestically and whether he is indeed representative of the aspirations of the local population of Benghazi in the eastern provinces, let alone the whole country. We don't actually know the depth of support for Qaddafi in the West. We know that in Sirte there may be some genuine support for Qaddafi. The same may be true in Tripoli. It's very hard to gauge the extent to which there is a unified opposition to this regime across all of the provinces. And we don't know who the rebels are precisely and who, therefore, were indirectly assisting in the bid to overthrow the current leadership. So what the consequences of the current action will be then in the medium or long term for Libyans, who may find themselves governed by forces we know very little about and they know very little about right now, or they might find themselves subjected to some form of international administration in a day-after scenario. Both of those are very open questions, what the consequences are for civilians and how we should assess the relative merits of that outcome versus simply the continuation of the current regime.
At the risk, Usler, of quoting Donald Rumsfeld, there are known unknowns and unknown unknowns. What we do seem to know, though, and I'm not sure about how you do a cost-benefit analysis in what the components are in terms of morality and humanity, etc. I mean, going to the last point there about Western boots on the ground or NATO boots on the ground as a stabilization force, the argument would be, well, they may in some way impinge upon the sovereignty of the Libyans, but on the other hand, they may also prevent the Libyans from killing each other in retribution, since the country seems to have a split. And as you point out, we don't really sure about what real support there is for the dictator. But what we do know, and as you pointed out, that people were being slaughtered in Benghazi, and more than would have been, and they are continually slaughtering people in Misrata. So at this point, can you give me a sense of the asymmetry between how many people Gaddafi's killed and how much collateral damage has been done by NATO?
No, it's very difficult to provide that kind of an assessment. I mean, obviously, there is, at this point, in terms of the reports that we have much clearer reporting from the eastern provinces, where you have international media present and able to sort of make assessments on their own, which gives us a sense of the amount of civilian casualties associated with actions by the Qaddafi regime. What we don't have is any way to compare that to what's happening in the West, since there's no clear, reliable information that's available from the parts of the country that are under Gaddafi's control and that have seen the most aerial bombardment. So right now, of course, the empirical evidence we have suggests that many more civilians have been killed by the Gaddafi regime than by any other actors, but we don't really have any way of knowing whether or not that's in fact a reliable estimate, because we don't know what's in fact happening in the West in terms of on-the-ground consequences. And again, one should point out that this doesn't, there's no suggestion here that NATO is either deliberately targeting civilians, of course, unlike the Gaddafi regime, which has had a record of deliberately targeting civilians. NATO, there's no reason to believe that that would be the case in NATO, and nor do we have any reason to think that the Tomahawk missiles that are being used are missing their target. But it's still important to note that many military objects are located in areas where there may also be civilians present, and so it's completely permissible as a matter of the laws of war to target those military objects, even if that targeting were to result in civilian casualties. And so what we do know about the relative assessment with respect to Gaddafi and NATO is that NATO is using much heavier armament, and they're using aerial bombardment as the principal tactic, which is, while you know, subject to precision targeting, it can never be compared to the kind of precision that you would be able to have if you were, in fact, an operator on the ground looking directly at your target. And moreover, the size of the impact that's being created by aerial bombardment runs a very serious risk of having consequences for whatever may be adjacent to or in the proximity of the intended target. And so while it's completely legally permissible as a matter of laws of war to target military objects, even if there is a real risk of collateral damage to civilians, when you're undertaking this kind of an exercise in the name of the humanitarian welfare of the civilian population, the fact that you use a tactic like aerial bombardment that does bear a disproportionate risk of civilian collateral damage, again, fully legal, but nonetheless, you know, a very heavy use of armament that runs a high risk, the question is that tactic really compatible with the alleged humanitarian goal that's being pursued through the intervention?
But Asla, this seems to raise the broader question of post-Cold War conflicts, where, beginning with George Bush Sr.'s intervention in Panama, where we went to arrest one criminal head of state and there was civilian collateral damage, then you go to the examples of Saddam Hussein twice and Milosevic, it seems that we wage war against people in order to get rid of a dictator protected by sovereignty, and the people who are the collateral damage, their only crime is that they live under a dictatorship, and we either subject them to sanctions or collateral damage, and that seems deeply dysfunctional. I know we have an international criminal court, but they seem totally feckless, and they're even going to indict Gaddafi. They've already indicted the head of state in Sudan, and they're running up huge law bills. So what kind of mechanism can there be, since you're an international lawyer, to solve this, I think, deeply immoral quandary that we're in?
Yes. Well, you make some excellent points, and I would just want to make one note, first of all, about your point about the International Criminal Court. I think it's an incredible error to have immediately resorted to a referral to the International Criminal Court with respect to Gaddafi in the earlier Security Council Resolution 1970 that was taken in late February. And in fact, I think that in some ways that produced the situation we find ourselves in now, because by referring Gaddafi at that moment to the International Criminal Court, the signal that was sent to the regime is that they are not going to be permitted to go to a sort of comfortable exile or retirement scenario that Ben Ali of Tunisia and Mubarak of Egypt have been able to enjoy in Saudi Arabia and Sharm el-Sheikh, respectively. So whereas there might have been a mechanism for persuading Gaddafi and his family to leave Libya and go, let's say, to Venezuela or Burkina Faso or Uganda or various other places that were being discussed at that time, that option was ridiculed. I think it was an instance of hubris, both internationally and among local actors in Libya. There was a belief that Gaddafi was about to fall, that this regime was going to be toppled quickly and with ease in the way that the regimes in Tunisia and Egypt were dislodged, and that this was an opportunity to vindicate a set of international norms. And so let's proceed directly. It was the very first action other than a presidential statement. The first action that was taken by the Security Council was already immediately in the register of coercion. So arms embargo, travel ban, asset freeze, International Criminal Court referral, which of course is completely out of keeping with the response that had been undertaken by the international community in previous instances in which regimes met democratic opponents with brutal repression. We've not seen that kind of a Security Council response to any of the other instances in the region today, nor have we seen that kind of a response in numerous other places where regimes are reacting with brutality to democratic demands on the part of their people. Cote d'Ivoire comes to mind and others. So the choice, that choice by the international community in Security Council Resolution 1970, I think set the stage for incentivizing this regime to dig in and fight. Now, they may have done that anyway. Again, that would be a question of a counterfactual. But at that moment, if humanitarianism was the principal goal that was being pursued, in my mind, the appropriate way to pursue that would have been to prioritize facilitating an exit of this regime into exile in some way. And then, of course, there's no statute of limitations on accountability for crimes against humanity if that is indeed what the Gaddafi regime is guilty of, and they could have easily made the referral to the International Criminal Court once he was safely out of the country, thereby saving lives and stabilizing the situation in Libya much more quickly. So I think that was an error to begin with, and I think the use of the International Criminal Court in this way is, while on the one hand will be defended by people saying, well, we can't allow impunity and so forth, I actually think it was very counterproductive. And even that argument, that what we're doing is establishing a precedent that says there will be no impunity for crimes against humanity, is actually sort of a mixed bag in the case of that particular referral, because those who defended that decision by the Security Council suggested that one reason for pursuing the International Criminal Court referral was to incentivize those around the regime to defect. But what that means is that the idea, this tactic was used basically to say to 11th hour defectors who themselves might have bloody hands that they will be able to enjoy impunity themselves by virtue of their 11th hour decision to defect. So people, for example, speak of the fact that Moussa Koussa was not included in the referral to the International Criminal Court or the travel ban, and that that was intended to signal to him that the international community would enable him to remain involved in a day-after scenario if the regime were to be ousted, and so incentivize him to defect. Well, but that incentive to defect and that suggestion that defectors will be immune from the referral also is you know, a sort of mixed bag in terms of vindicating the view that international accountability is, you know, a principle that can be vindicated and that there will be no impunity for crimes against humanity. So putting that aside, putting aside the International Criminal Court question, you also raise this idea that we're in a post-Cold War world of humanitarian interventions, and how can these be undertaken in a way that is more protective of civilians in light of the sort of quandary we face now, where on the one hand we intervene in defense of the humanitarian welfare of a population, on the other hand we're only willing to use a tactic which enables our own force protection, so minimizes harm that may be done to our own forces because everything is conducted aerially, but that of course raises a very serious potential harm of collateral damage to the civilians on behalf of whom we're intervening. And that is a very serious problem. But I also want to note that there's a Cold War element, Cold War dimension to the issue that we're facing now, because we have an experience prior to the Panama and so forth, the examples that you gave, in Afghanistan, in which we also decided that we would be strongly in favor of an armed insurgency in order to depose an adversary, in that case a Soviet-backed government in Afghanistan, and that we decided to provide all kinds of assistance covertly. And that's, again, something that's being hotly debated right now in Washington, and there's reason to think that the British and the French have already initiated a similar action, which is to say funneling finances and arms to the rebels in Libya in order to provide them with direct material support and potentially also the possibility of covert operations by various non-military actors. So whereas the Obama administration, President Obama has said that we will not pursue military means to directly occasion regime change, that leaves open the possibility of using non-military means, meaning covert operations, to produce that effect. So we're in a world right now where there's a real possibility of finance and arms being funneled to the rebels with potential U.S. participation and covert operations being undertaken in there to support them, because, of course, these rebels appear to need much more than just arms. They need training. They need logistical support. They need to understand basic military tactics. I mean, they're a very ragtag group from what we can see that are rarely able to make advances unless the path has been completely cleared for them aerially by the now NATO-commanded assault. In this scenario, what we're seeing is a potential echoes of this, the Cold War scenario in Afghanistan, with all of the risks associated with it. We don't know who these actors are. We don't know what their objectives may be in a day-after scenario. All we know about them is that they're united in opposition to this particular regime, and we share that opposition. But beyond that, we have no idea what they actually may be pursuing in terms of the day-after scenario. And in fact, we have reason to think that at least some of them may be deemed relatively unsavory by the very Western powers that would now intervene to assist them. So that's a very Cold War problem that we have in this particular instance, in addition to the post-Cold War humanitarianism scenario that you raised.
Well, I'm afraid we've run out of time here, and I thank you for joining us here today.
Thanks very much.
I've been speaking with Asla Bali, who's a professor at the UCLA School of Law, where she teaches courses on public international law, international human rights, and the laws of war. We'll now take a brief station break and be back talking with Mark Danner. Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing, and I'm now joined by Mark Danner, who is a writer, journalist, and professor. His latest book, now out in paperback, is Stripping Bare the Body, Politics, Violence, War. His other books include The Secret Way to War, The Downing Street Memo, and The Iraq War's Buried History, and Torture and Truth, America's Abu Ghraib and the War on Terror. Mark Danner was a longtime staff writer for The New Yorker, and he's a regular contributor to The New York Review of Books and teaches at the University of California and Bard College. And Mark Danner will be appearing at a benefit for our sister station KPFA in the Bay Area this Friday, speaking about the Arab Spring. Welcome to Background Briefing, Mark Danner.
Thanks, Ian. It's very good to be here.
And in terms of the Arab Spring, there is, of course, spring and winter of their discontent, if you will, in terms of Libya, whereas we had a nonviolent revolution, largely so in Tunisia and in Egypt. This, of course, is the dark side of change. What is your sense of how this might end up? Because it's obviously creating a kind of, in a curious way, creating a rift within the left itself. But we can talk about that in a minute. Just your general impressions of how this...
John, you're asking me to give my impression of how this might end up. I'm reminded of the Yogi Berra line, you know, I never make predictions, especially about the future. And this one is extremely perilous, I think, to try to predict what is going to evolve. It should be said, first of all, that though this is clearly a kind of contiguous phenomenon, one thing is certainly affecting others. You know, the turmoil in one country is, as it were, sweeping across a region, that these are very different events, very different. Things as they are evolving in Egypt, which is a very large country of 80 million, are very, very distinct from what's happening in Libya, which is a much smaller place, though a very large country, a small population, mostly grouped along the coast. And that, of course, has become quite violent. The Western alliance has taken sides, although, in fact, the side that the West has taken, we really don't know very much about. The rebels are not well known. They include some very senior officials in Gaddafi's government, including the interior minister, who only resigned scarcely a month ago. So this is the man in charge of much of the repressive apparatus of the Libyan state, who up until, you know, was a pal of Gaddafi's until about a month ago. And there are other senior officials as well, who've only very recently resigned. So the character of the opposition is difficult to evaluate, and all of this has become, in a sense, packaged as the Arab Spring. And indeed, I think the fact that especially Europeans saw the Libyan events as very much part of a wave of democratic upheaval was what made this intervention particularly popular in Europe. And the Europeans really did lead the way here. The problem is that the democratic content of much of this is certainly uncertain, to coin a phrase. I mean, Libya especially, obviously, we don't know how that will evolve. The rebels, such as they are, seem to be very, very militarily weak. So that's an intervention that could very well leave Gaddafi in power and leave the Western powers essentially holding the bag and faced with a very difficult decision about whether to up their intervention or, in fact, leave Gaddafi in power and the country, in effect, divided. Egypt, on the other hand, which is probably the most important of these political events, is itself enormously complicated right now. They've had a referendum to change the constitution, which passed by 77%, an open vote, and we can cheer that on. But it also should be said that the democratic activists of Tahrir Square that everyone was so enthusiastic about, in fact, opposed that referendum. So it gives, in a sense, some indication of what the true electoral state of play is in Egypt, that having made a vigorous opposition, traveled around the country and all the rest of it, they got fewer than one in four Egyptians who voted with that democratic opposition. It suggests that still the people who are organized on the ground and who may have a much stronger weight in the elections are the political groupings that already exist, which is the Muslim Brotherhood and the remnants of Mubarak's party, the NDF. So that itself is quite complicated. And then we have Bahrain, which was a movement, a very vivid, strong movement, largely led by, populated by the Shia, who are a majority of the country, even though it's Sunni ruled, that was suppressed fairly brutally with the help of Saudi troops. And now, off on the periphery, a fascinating series of events, you have a rising in Syria, which has become bloody very quickly, and which we have fairly limited information about because Western reporters are simply not let in by the regime. We don't know how that will evolve. And, of course, I haven't mentioned Iran, which is, along with Saudi Arabia and Egypt, is the third great power of the area, where you've had a democratic movement that's been brutally suppressed. And we don't know what the future of that regime will be either. So apart from that, Ian, everything is clear.
Well, again, I'm speaking with Mark Denner, author of Stripping Bare the Body, Politics, Violence, War, now out in paperback. But I think you could make the case, surely, Mark Denner, that amongst the people who are propelling these revolutions, whether they're peaceful or bloody, there is a symmetry, I think, throughout the Middle East that young, educated, tech-savvy Arabs are just fed up with having their future stolen either by these potentates, princes, or these colonels, and they're fed up and they're not going to take it anymore. The differences are in the qualities of the dictatorships and the extent to which they're prepared to use naked brutality. And Mubarak backed down, Gaddafi won't back down, the Assads won't back down, and I don't believe the House of Saud. By the way, it's worth pointing out that apparently every day during the Egyptian crisis, the King Abdullah of Saudi Arabia, that our sometimes ridiculous press calls a reformer, berated Obama every day, saying, give Mubarak permission to start shooting those students in Tahrir Square.
Yes.
That's our friend the Saudi. So isn't that what's really going on here? It's more about the dictators than the people. The people are all the same in these places, as far as I can tell, particularly the young.
Well, I think it's very useful that you brought up that incident with the king, who is indeed our, perhaps along with Mubarak, was our closest ally in the region, and who apparently did not refuse to receive the Secretary of Defense, Robert Gates, on his last trip last week through the region. He's so peeved at the Obama administration for not sticking by Mubarak, and as you say, urging him to open fire on the demonstrators. But I guess I would perhaps disagree with you slightly. I think that I certainly agree that there's a similar theme running throughout these upheavals. That it's first of all demographic. That is, we're talking about young people who, in many cases, are educated but have very few job prospects. We're talking about societies that, on the whole, are very young, are skewed very much toward youth. For the demographic cohort is very large. That is certainly true. It's also true that technology has helped. But I guess, as my description of what happened in Egypt was meant to suggest, it isn't clear whether, even though if this is the vanguard of these events, whether indeed that will tell when it comes to what indeed the result is. I agree with you that those things are in common, but I don't necessarily agree that those are going to be the political are going to hold the political weight of what comes after. I think there it's up in the air whether that will be what you see as a result in Egypt, for example, whether you see in fact the open, democratic, youthful, technocratically directed, modernizing, secular forces that we as Westerners simply want to see. And this comes down not only to those looking at this on their television sets, but also to the reporters, because these are the people the reporters can easily speak to and who are educated like they are, who can speak English and so on. And we almost mask behind this vanguard are much larger societies, much more complicated, and I would argue much less clearly in support of a democratic, in many cases, much more clearly in support of a democratic outcome. So I think there are differences. I mean, you say that there are differences in the dictators and how they respond. That's definitely true. And I would add to that that there are differences, obviously, in the U.S. relationships to these dictators, which are absolutely critical. When it comes to Egypt and Saudi Arabia, these have been the closest U.S. Alliances in the region, in the case of Saudi Arabia, for 60 years, in the case of Egypt, for 30. This is absolutely critical, the U.S. interest in these transitions. Of course, Saudi Arabia, there is no transition at present. In other countries like Syria and Libya, in a sense, the interests of the U.S. are, in a way, somewhat simpler. I hesitate to say that since the situation in Libya in particular is so complicated. But these have been regimes that have been traditionally enemies of the United States for a long time, and the U.S. is not ambivalent or ambiguous about wanting them to go. The question is what will follow them.
In the last few minutes then, just turn to the subject, if I may, Mark Danner, of the split in the left, both in Europe here in the United States, over the intervention in Libya. There's a surreal situation going on now with the Western press holed up in the one hotel in Tripoli where the Gaddafi's people are parading before them these kind of boneheaded European leftists who are ranting at the journalists and talking about imperialist intervention and stuff. And
I saw that in Iraq as well,
yeah,
by the way.
And I recall back at the time of Milosevic, a similar divide. And of course, what Milosevic and Gaddafi have so much in common is they both stole their national treasuries. And in Milosevic's case, he parked it in Cyprus and then emptied the jails, hired all the psychopaths and set them loose on his neighbors, created the first genocide in Europe since the Nazis. But still, a part of the left felt that NATO's involvement there was imperialism. Mm-hmm. So what's your analysis then of this difference between the liberal interventionists and the kind of knee-jerk anti-imperialists?
Well, you know, this is I think you sketched that out very well, and this is a division that we have seen going back 20 years anyway, or longer than that in its roots. We've had a lot of return of the past, the mention of Srebrenica, again and again the discussion of Bosnia, which similarly divided people, not completely the same division, but quite similar. And Samantha Power, who's in the Obama administration, supposedly talked about Srebrenica and urging Obama to back the intervention, which of course had been pushed very hard by the French and by the British and the Italians, most of all. I think, you know, when you look at the divisions here, you're talking about liberal internationalists and idealists, and the idealists, what might be called Wilsonian idealists, really span the middle ground between left and right. I mean, we're talking about, you know, you don't have to go too far to the right when you're talking to a liberal idealist and a Wilsonian who wants to spread democracy or is concerned about humanitarian intervention, which Obama appealed to so strongly in his speech, you don't have to go too far to the right to bump into neoconservatives. I mean, neoconservatives are just have very similar sentiments. They don't talk about humanitarianism quite in quite as juicy terms. They talk about the mission of the United States to spread democracy around the globe. I mean, these are words that eventually appeared in the mouth, astonishingly enough, of George W. Bush in his second inaugural.
Well, the fundamental difference between neoconservatives and liberal interventionists is one hates the UN and thinks we should just trample over them to get our way, and the other says, oh, we should use the UN because they're useful.
Absolutely. I think, you know, you put your finger on something, which is the difference isn't what should be done. The difference is the sort of modalities of American power and American power's relationship to multilateral institutions. That's absolutely, absolutely correct. And I think also when you, I mean, I agree with that, and I admire the concision with which you stated it. And what I was going to say is that when you look at those who are anti-interventionist, you're talking also about realists, again, on both sides of the political spectrum. People who are worried about how this thing could end up, people who worry that we have no exit strategy, quote-unquote. I mean, these are terms that go back to at least to the early 80s when you had an argument between George Shultz, then Secretary of State, and Caspar Weinberger. And you had the coining of the Weinberger Doctrine and then the Powell Doctrine, all of which was supposed to restrain U.S. intervention abroad by setting down certain requirements. We need to use overwhelming force. We need to have the support of the American population. We need to have clear goals. We need to have clear national interests. And these restrictions were some of the things that prevented U.S. intervention early on in Bosnia, of course. And one of the distinctive things about this intervention is it breaks almost every one of those rules, almost methodically. In fact, the only one it keeps to is the need to build build international support.
Well, Mark, I'm afraid we've run out of time here in Los Angeles, but I'm very grateful for you joining us here today.
Well, it's my pleasure, Ian.
Again, I've been speaking with Mark Danner, whose latest book is Stripping Bare the Body, Politics, Violence, War, now out in paperback. He'll also be appearing at a benefit for our sister station, KPFA, in the Bay Area this Friday, speaking about the Arab Spring. Let's now take a brief station break, and we'll be back talking about the end of Wall Street. Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing. Joining me now is Roger Lowenstein, author of The End of Wall Street, which is just out in paperback. Roger Lowenstein is a financial journalist who wrote for The Wall Street Journal for more than a decade and continues to write for The New York Times, Smart Money, and other publications. Other books include When Genius Failed, The Rise and Fall of Long-Term Capital Management, Origins of the Crash, The Great Bubble and Its Undoing, While America Aged, How Pension Debts Ruined General Motors, Stopped the New York City Subways, Bankrupted San Diego, and Loom as the Next Financial Crisis. Welcome to Background Briefing, Roger Lowenstein.
Ian, it's very good to be on the show.
Just reading your book credits here, it sounds like you're a prophet of doom.
You know, Ian, that's occurred to me, and it wasn't by intent. In fact, after the previous book on pensions, I said to my editor, you know, I want to do something cheerier or not one of these, running financial crises books. And I just come back in the spring of 08 from a book tour, and she calls up and says, what do you think about Bear Stearns? And, it was obvious she wanted me to do a book on that. And I sort of pushed her off for a bit. And then it was, what do you think about Fannie and Freddie? And I sort of said, well, this thing will blow over, you know. But obviously it didn't. And I think she called again after Lehman failed and that terrible week in September. And so, yes, once again, I was a chronicler, if not a prophet of doom.
Well, I think for the sake of the audience, we should probably clarify, the end of Wall Street was about all of the above that you were finally sort of sucked back into writing about, because it was the story of the century, if you will, the near-death experience of the global economy.
I really think so. I'm glad you brought it up because, the same way you may get a tremor, a series of tremors before the big quake, I think if we look back at the financial history that you know, our generation has lived through, the Black Monday stock market crash, the junk bond, the SNL fiascos, the dot-com mania, and there are many others. You know, we're living in an age of tremendous financial volatility, which is not unrelated to the financial freedoms and deregulations of the last couple of decades. And, you know, in particular, in the era of Alan Greenspan, the theory was propagated that anything goes, and anything that, that private bankers do, by the way, including, you know, whatever kind of mortgage you want to write, was fine. And I think, you know, this episode was this big quake. It was really the result of the culmination of that sort of speculation, an absolute laissez-faire approach.
So how do you explain, though, and obviously it's easy in retrospect, and even Alan Greenspan himself had to do a kind of conditional mea culpa, or you know, somewhat like the, you know, the piano player in the whorehouse. You know,
that's right. But you know, when he said it, it's sort of like the captain of the Titanic apologizing for hitting the iceberg. I mean, right. You know, I will credit, you're right. I mean, let's at least give Alan credit for saying, you know, he was wrong. We can't always trust markets, but go ahead. You were going.
Well, I was going to say, how did he get to become the sage and the guru? I mean, he was the executive of Ayn Rand's estate, and how could a third-rate Hollywood writer become such a great economic prophet and have such a devoted disciple?
You know, you may recall when Greenspan once said, "If I've been speaking clearly, you must have misunderstood me." But you know, he cultivated this image of being the sage, of being mystical and indeed obscure. And I think it wasn't just his obscurity, you know, but you know, he presided over a very happy and, for the most part, a buoyant economic age. And you know, does the man make history, or history make the man? Were all of the central bankers in the 1970s so bad, or was the combination of, you know, oil shocks and so on, did that just make it a very tough era? I think he really rode the wave of you know, the wonderful economy we had in the 90s, the balanced budget that Clinton and the Republican Congress reached jointly in the 90s, and, you know, like the coach with great players, you know, he seemed to have this stardust.
Again, I'm speaking with Roger Lowenstein, author of The End of Wall Street, which is just out in paperback. But is there something to all of these crashes that you've covered in your various books, culminating with this near-death experience for the global economy in the fall of 2008, in the sense that what seems to come out of it is that the insiders get more powerful, and, you know, now we're talking about these too big to fail banks being bigger than ever. I just spoke the other day to the former head of Commodities and Futures Trading Commission. It was about the price of oil and the price of food, which are going up precipitously, and asked about the extent to which Wall Street is gaming, and something like $40 billion is being placed through these Wall Street bookies on whether oil will go up. And of course, that's driving up oil, as we know from the fall of 2008, when it got up to $147 a barrel. So there is there's something about this that, to me, feels sort of un-American, that the poor guy at the pump, the working stiff and the middle class overworked person, American, has to be gouged in order for people to speculate. I don't get it.
Yeah, I don't think Wall Street has control over what happens to the price of oil or the price of real estate, for that matter. Otherwise, you know, neither one of them would have crashed. You know, oil is now going through a cycle and a half because it's back up, right? But I do think that there's way too much trading and gaming going on. That, you know, the point of trading is to have a little bit of liquidity in the market, so that when real producers of oil and real refiners and real users, so that they have a market to unload their wares, so that the rest of us, we can go to the pump and there'll be gasoline there. But when you get a market that is overwhelmed in either direction, by the way, up or down, by people speculating on which direction oil prices are going, Yes, I think that the tail's wagging the dog. Firms like Goldman Sachs used to be primarily in the business of raising capital, which was a useful function for society. If you were starting a business or you were expanding a business, you went to Goldman and you know, they floated shares or debt or whatever, and you could expand the business. 90% of Goldman's revenues now are entirely to do with trading, you know, which is just a zero-sum game. Goldman wins and someone loses, or someone wins and Goldman loses. And when too many traders pile up on one side or another, yes, it will distort the prices of the of the underlying asset for real people. I'm not, you know, we have all this trading in mortgage securities, which obviously, you know, greatly impacted the country in 2008. Before we had mortgage securities, we did not have a housing shortage. I mean, the fundamental purpose of the housing market, which is to provide shelter to Americans or whatever country, was being met. And I agree with you that the market was greatly destabilized to no particular productive end by the creation of all of these betting securities, particularly derivatives, which raise no money, which funnel no money into productive purposes, but are only really casinos, big bets, where one party's betting A and one party's betting A.
Well, I think it's reached a point of kind of surreality, if you will, Roger Lowenstein, given that the big brokerage houses like Goldman Sachs apparently have moved their computers as close as possible to the New York Stock Exchange computer so that they have the advantage of the speed of light.
That's right, because if there are this flash trading, which actually precipitated that crash of about a year ago when the market fell 1,000 points or something in a minute and then immediately went back, something completely bizarre. This is all done by computers who trade in and out of stocks in less than a second, so that it becomes important for Goldman and anyone else traveling at the speed of light to not be physically too far. This is absolutely absurd. There is no social purpose whatsoever served by computers trading in and out. The function of the stock market is to allow buyers and sellers to analyze securities so that they can price them accurately, so that through the pricing mechanism, capital is allocated in the proportion that society needs to housing and steel and airplanes and software and so on. I just don't think computers who are buying and selling in less than a second are fulfilling that role. And that's something that I would outlaw. I just would.
Again, I'm speaking with Roger Lowenstein, author of The End of Wall Street, which is just out in paperback. So your book, the recent one, and the earlier books and the work that you've done with your decade with The Wall Street Journal and now with The New York Times and Smart Money, how about sort of some reflection on the state of American capitalism? Just the weight of what you're telling me makes me wonder whether I thought that capitalism was not supposed to be about extracting wealth, but about creating wealth. And much of what we're talking about is simply about extracting wealth.
Let me join those two ideas. You know, Winston Churchill's line that democracy is the worst system ever invented, except for any other that's been tried. I think that's still true for capitalism, vis-a-vis, other economic systems. The idea of capitalism, to get to your point about extraction, wealth extraction, or wealth creation, it's supposed to be the creation of it that enables people to extract it. If Bill Gates creates a successful firm, Microsoft, he's going to get rich, and he did. And on the other hand, if someone creates a firm that fails, they shouldn't get rich. And that link, A, provides a sense of fairness to the rest of us, and two, it sends the right incentive. It means that the future Bill Gates of the world want to make sure their firms succeed. And what's happened, I think particularly in America, has been a severing of that link. Boards of directors have become generous is too weak a word, just in an unseemly way, doling out these huge bonuses, regardless of how people, how the firms do. I looked at compensation of Larry Ellison recently, and he made $70 million this year, $85 the year before, $85 million the year before that. By the way, the stock is up about 1% a year over 10 years. I mean, that is a gross perversion. It's you know, he to me is less a true capitalist than he is a socialist taxing his shareholders regardless of his performance. And so we have a real problem at the board level, and I think a real problem in terms of the shareholders' right to determine pay and to determine who their representatives on the board will be. We also have an incentive problem beneath the level of the CEO. If you think about the traders at Merrill Lynch in this episode and Lehman and the other firms, they were getting big bonuses for the amount of trades, the size of the trades they put on. Years later, if those trades went bad and the firms went downhill, the traders, well, they'd already pocketed their bonuses. You know, that is absolutely crazy. I mean, when you can't pay for someone for work that is going to end up in bankrupting their firm. Mm-hmm. So it's this disconnect between wealth extraction and true wealth creation. And wealth creation doesn't mean that you get the stock to go up for an hour and a half. It means that you've created an enduring enterprise which is going to generate profits, you know, for a long time that will pay employees and contribute taxes to society and the rest. And I think that's what we need to reestablish.
And of course, now there's an extra casino going on here with you mentioned the high tech. Facebook, of course, is still private, and it did a deal with Goldman Sachs to satisfy the insiders. So the average investor is not even in the game anymore. I mean, don't you think? I've only got a couple of seconds left here, but I don't mean to monopolize your time.
Well, you know, Facebook is a tricky one because I'm not prepared to say that it's worth $50 billion. You know, Ian, I'm not prepared to say that it's not. I don't use Facebook. I'm the wrong generation, but an awful lot of people do. I think the problem, whether it's in high tech or elsewhere, is that when people are paid off for short-term performance or short-term deals or short-term stock prices, or they write a mortgage and immediately flip it, so they're paid just for writing the mortgage and not for whether the mortgage is any good. It, up and down the line, it creates the wrong incentives. And by the way, this extended to the individual borrower because, you know, they went out and took out maybe an option ARM mortgage that was a $200 a month payment. It jumped up to, in some cases, $600-$700 a month, and that person just said, "Well, I'll refinance. I don't have to worry about it." They were also just watching the short term. And you know, when everybody's watching the short term and thinking they can get out, they'll sell the bad security. When the music stops, not everybody can get out at once. So I, you know, if there's an endemic cultural problem to Wall Street and American capitalism, that short-term focus goes a long way towards explaining it.
Well, I thank you so much for joining us here in Los Angeles, Roger Lowenstein.
Ian, a real pleasure.
Again, I've been speaking with Roger Lowenstein, who's the author of The End of Wall Street, which is just out in paperback. This has been Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters. I would like to thank my producer Spencer Downing and Kim Nassiter. Our theme music is by Los Lobos. You may hear this program, sign up for podcasts, and contact me at ianmasters.com. I've also started a daily blog there. Go to ianmasters.com and click on blog and let me know what you think. I'll be back again tomorrow with another Background Briefing. Bye for now.